Hello and welcome. You are listening to Unbossed and Unbothered here with the 10th Voice, KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City's community radio. I'm your host, D. Rashawn Gilmore, back for another installment. I think this is episode 8 for us, and I always marvel at how these shows come together. And I have to open the show with a shout out to my sister, because on Facebook, and those of you watching via Facebook Live, hey, you might also want to tune in to the website, kkfi.org, so you can hear callers later and music that'll be played since we don't have live studio guests. But it's my sister Dana Gilmore who always massages my nerves before each episode, and I have been sick the past few days, and she told me I don't want to hear you hacking and coughing on the radio. So I've got some peach tea and it's got ginger and lemon in it, so I'm hoping I'll be all right today. If I start hacking, one of my guests will just have to take over, and that's gonna be that. So in any event, I am happy that we're here on St. Patrick's Day, because the first segment of my show is Reclaiming My Time, and I want to reclaim my time on St. Patrick's Day. Now, I know that there are a great many people out there who have probably heard the term Irish slaves. Let me be clear. There is no such thing. There never was any such thing as Irish slavery. So a lot of times what happens is black folk talk about slavery and the experiences of our forefathers and foremothers, and people say to us, well, the Irish were slaves and they did all right. You'll see them complaining. Let me tell you something. They were indentured servants. That means they may have had a debt and they had to work 7 years, sometimes more, to pay that debt off, and then they were released. But they were never owned like property, which is what chattel slavery was, which is what Africans from the diaspora experienced in this country. So I get really irritated when I hear people talk about Irish slavery. Let me just say this one more time. Never happened. Never happened. Other than that, enjoy your St. Patrick's Day. I think I have some green on, so don't pinch me because I'm not here for that. It may not go well for you. It's been a very rough past couple of weeks, and today's show is very different than any of my other broadcasts because of the focus and subject matter that we're dealing with today. But, you know, I've said over and over again that I'm always so thankful that I can draw from such a rich bounty of friends and family to help make this show happen. And today is no different. Our hearts are a little heavy, and that is because nearly two weeks ago tomorrow, one of my friends, a beloved member of our community, was slain literally across the street from our Midtown studios. I'm looking out of the window in the studio and I can see the spot from here. And it was senseless. It was horrific. We're told that he didn't suffer. His name is Teron Carson, Rio to some, T-Rock to others, a beautiful person inside and out. And it was a senseless and tragic loss. He was leaving a club just down the street, waiting for friends to come to the car, and a vehicle pulled up and two or more individuals jumped out and began shooting. And in the aftermath of that, his life was taken. I woke up that Sunday morning to a flurry of text messages and Facebook messages. I thought, well, what in the world is going on? Usually if that happens to me, I've posted something and people are reacting. And then I got a call. So thank you, Devin Hersey. One of the fellows with Blackout called me and said, did you hear about Rio? I said, well, no, what about Rio? What? And I was overcome with emotion. I was overcome immediately with grief. I began to cry because I just couldn't imagine any circumstance where he would be a victim, certainly not in a situation where it was warranted or provoked. It was inconceivable to me. But beyond that, it was just the tragedy of the loss. And so I reached out to a few friends, one of whom is going to join us by phone because he's the person who introduced me to Rio 5 years ago. And I wanted to make sure he was okay and had heard the news. And as I was talking with he and other friends, I said, we got to do something and we can't wait. Some good folks were planning a vigil for, you know, the following weekend. But something in me was like, we got to do something now. And I know some folks maybe felt it was too soon, but I have to say, and I get choked up thinking about it because it was just so moving to see the hundreds of people who turned out for the candlelight vigil at the Center for Spiritual Living just up the street and who also participated in the solidarity walk from the Center for Spiritual Living about a mile to the intersection of 39th and Main here in Kansas City. And it was beautiful. And it was, there are those rare occasions when I feel like I'm experiencing what heaven must be like in terms of its diversity. And to see the broad diversity, true diversity, people who didn't even know him, but people who maybe just met Rio because he worked at Chipotle or maybe he did their makeup at Mac or something or Sephora. And they knew him and they came because they cared, because they were a part of the community and he was a part of the community. And it was just a beautiful thing. We went from a candlelight vigil to a few days later, our own Flo, Kansas City's queen of drag. She's not just a drag queen. She's the queen of drag. John Coop, we love you. John reached out to me and said, we've got to do something. I want to help raise money, too. And folks gave on Facebook. But Sunday night, literally a week to the day, we went to Missy B's and Flo raised over $1,200 that night with the family there. And it was just such a beautiful tribute. And it was really meaningful and it was a great time. The next day was the funeral. And that was rough. And it was rough because I don't think any of us ever anticipated what that might be like. But I have to tell you, there was so much support, so much love in that space. I know that it can sound easy to just want to move past our grief, and that's not always possible. And one of my very closest friends is a professional in the mental health field, and I asked him if he would be a part of our show today. His name is Jermaine Alberti, and Jermaine is someone who has worked extensively in mental health, also in community development and with community-based organizations, and is currently a pastor in Columbia, Missouri. Jermaine, do we have you on the line?
I am here.
Hey, my friend. Thank you so much for making time to be with us today. So you kind of helped me walk this down, as my friend Natasha Elskari would say, walk down this whole process of grieving. How are people supposed to cope when it's not like it was an older person who had lived a robust, full life, and you can kind of wrap your minds around that, or perhaps it's somebody who had a sickness and you got some time to wrap your mind around that, but when it's sudden, a car wreck, a murder, these kinds of things, like, how do you deal?
Well, you know, that question is one that a lot of folks wrestle with when they get bad news they didn't expect. And many people have heard the five stages of grief. I've uncovered what is called a seven stages of grief. And in that seven stage, the first one is shock. Shock and denial. And shock provides this emotional protection from being overwhelmed all at once. And this shock sometimes lasts for weeks on end. So some folks are just still in shock. They haven't even got to the anger or bargaining or the depression or reflection. They just need to be in shock. And so I think once the shock wears off, that's when all these other emotions start coming at you. And people often ask me, well, how long are you supposed to grieve? And the answer really, truly is grief has no expiration date.
Okay, so let me drill down on that a little bit. You just said something really profound there, because I have heard people talk about their grief or tell other people, like, it shouldn't take you that long or it's been X amount of time. But you said something really profound. Grief has no expiration date. Grief has an expiration date. Can you break that down a little bit further for me, or why that is, or why that should be?
Well, I think that if we think about life as episodes, you have episodes where you're feeling good and you can accept the fact that, yes, this person has gone, and enjoy the moments that you have with them. And then out of anywhere, out of nowhere, episode just hits you of, I miss this person.
Like a wave. Like,
yeah, I mean, just like a wave just hits you. And you have to be able to understand that life is like that ocean. There's that calm, but then a wave may just hit you. And so you have to just find yourself grounded in your faith or in your spirituality or your friends or your circle. find grounding in there. But it's important to understand that grief may hit you like a wave out of nowhere. And it's that support system around you that you build for self-care that helps when those waves hit you.
Well, you also mentioned something else that I find very important, that piece about self-care. And I was already, my fuel tank, my emotional, spiritual fuel tank was already very low. In fact, I was probably on the reserve tank and it was on fumes. And then I was compelled or even thrust into an organizing role for the vigil and for the solidarity walk and some of the other components. I marveled at the fact that as tired and exhausted as I was with everything else that was going on in life and in work, I had energy. I had grace when it came to doing it, and it wasn't a struggle. Any of the things, it just was not a struggle. And I've got the family in studio with me. I want them to, I haven't said that to you guys. It wasn't a struggle for me. It didn't exhaust me. In fact, on a certain level, it energized me to know that I was playing some part in helping us all to heal. But Jermaine, I did something that a lot of people either don't allow themselves to do or they think is wrong. I practice what I call radical self-care. And for me, that's a full stop. Bam. I completely shut my phone off for a week or nearly a week. I mean, it was off. Like, no calls, no texts. One or two friends, Langston Jones, who's doing video for us today for Facebook Live, did come by my house. And he knew how to get me good. He had a box of chicken wings from Go Chicken Go. But I had just left the house. So I missed it. And he didn't bring it with him today, I noticed, too. But that's okay. But is it okay to give yourself that permission without checking with anybody? I didn't text anybody and say, hey, I'm checking out for a little bit. I just did it. Like, is that okay or is that harmful?
I think that self-care is so important and that folks don't confuse self-care with self-centeredness. Even if, though, you are self-centered, that's okay to be healthy, too, because sometimes some of us feel like we have to be selfless and not selfish. But sometimes it is important to center on oneself and take care of yourself. And I would say two tips before we end our time together is what you just did. You changed your routine. And sometimes self-care is changing your routine.
Okay, that's good.
So here's another key thing is learning how to laugh at what you know. Sometimes just finding something funny, senseless, just to laugh at. Because we know laughter is do it good, like a good medicine.
You know, that's really...
So find an opportunity just to laugh.
It's funny that you should say that you should find an opportunity to laugh as part of the healing. Because I have to say, and I'm going to be bringing her into the conversation here momentarily, but... Rio's cousin, and I explained to one of my white friends recently, I said in black families, older cousins are like your aunties or your uncles. All of my younger cousins call me uncle. As far as I know, they don't call me auntie yet. But she was every bit what I needed. Like, we found so many moments to laugh. And I think this is her natural personality, so I think that is key. Jermaine, I'm going to ask you... And because they're not mic'd up and they have on headphones, they won't be able to hear you, but they'll get the playback. What would you say as an individual, a mental health professional, as a spiritual leader to grieving parents who are sitting in front of you who just lost their child to a circumstance like this?
That it's okay to be mad. That it's okay to be angry. But once you process being angry and being mad, the next step is what do we take to act to resolve that anger and that being mad and to ensure the legacy of your loved one lives on so that the world sees the goodness that they brought and not the horrible way that he left this place.
That's beautiful. And in fact, when they are on us, on in the B block, the second half of the show, I'm going to ask that question. I know it's something that they have given great and careful consideration to. Jermaine Alberti, thank you so much for being with us. Your website is?
It is www.saltinitiative.org.
Saltinitiative.org.
Saltinitiative.org, yes.
Initiative. Okay, wonderful. Jermaine, thank you so much. I look forward to having you on air again, but next time in studio, can you promise me we'll do that soon?
We'll make it happen.
Much love, my friend. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
That was good stuff. Okay, so I'm going to bring in some other folks here into the conversation, but that was some really good stuff. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to focus on your self-care, and one way you do that is by changing up your routine. That has value, 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 and it's okay to laugh. I just have gone through, as I'm sure all of our next guests have, a flurry of emotions, but I think that even in my grieving, laughter has been a big part of that. I am joined now in studio by Sean Alexander, a.k.a. Chandretta, to all who know. You know, and I have to ask you, because your pronouns for me, and I've always done this, and you've never corrected me, so there's your chance to do that now. I will frequently say her or he, like, is that okay?
It is very okay. I'm very, acceptable and fluent. Her, him, I don't give a
Yeah, so we can't do that, okay. But yes. Great, I appreciate that. Chandretta, and actually, I know you. We did. Because of Rio.
Yeah.
I met you. We were in the club one night, and you guys were both in drag.
Yes.
You were both in drag. In fact,
TC2 forever.
when he came over to me, I was like, okay, sis, back up. I don't even know who you are, and why are you up on me like this? And so it took a minute. I was like, oh my God, it's Rio. You're beautiful. And introduced me to you, and we've since worked together and built a friendship, which I value very deeply. On the phone, we have Michael Farmer, who is the person who introduced me to Rio. So Michael introduced me to Rio. Rio introduced me to you. Michael, are you on the phone with us?
Yes. Hey, everybody.
Hey, thank you for joining us.
I'm sick. Good afternoon.
That's okay. You're being a trooper. You're not feeling well, but you're making yourself available on the phone. I just wanted to have you guys tell me a little bit about your friend, Rio. And either one of you can jump in wherever you want to start.
Well, for me, you know, Rio has always just been like my sister. So that's why it's still so unreal to me when we're sitting here talking about this, because Rio and I were supposed to be like on tour, you know, making our albums. We're supposed to be on the radio talking about our music and, you know, ourselves and our drag and all of this, you know, on the road to stardom. So it's just really difficult and weird to be here sitting up looking at his obituary, and I'm like, ugh, my sister's supposed to be sitting next to me. But he was just a really amazing guy, and I think that was a testament at his funeral and at his vigil, all the different walks of life and all the different mm-hmm. faces, everybody that was there to support, and you just knew that he was just so much love and just purity, to be completely honest. I cannot even remember a day that I just, you know, seen real, like, have a breakdown moment where he's, you know, sad or, you know, yeah, or upset.
I was trying to find that moment too, because I wanted to be objective. I was like, well, let me be objective. I cannot think to this moment of a single time I've ever seen Rio mad or caught up in a bunch of mess, or it just didn't happen.
No.
And you spoke of, and I got a specific question for you, Michael, in just a second, but you spoke, Dretta, of you guys being on tour and on stage, and I'm reminded of Tariq, his dad's comments at the vigil. And he said, he was on the front row, of course. He said, I didn't want to look back. But when he got up on stage, he could see all those hundreds of people. And he said, this is not a vigil. This is an award ceremony, because this is where my son belongs. And that just gripped me. So, and if you knew Rio, he was every bit a superstar.
A star.
And at the funeral.
Vanity star. Don't get it to me. Vanity star.
At the funeral, I was not my next guest. I'm going to get her back because she made me speak. I was not planning to speak. But I said to the audience assembled there that sometimes certain stars shine so bright that they just burn out.
That was so powerful.
Shooting stars. Because I kept trying to, you know, preachers say, don't ask why. No, I'm going to ask why. I wouldn't want to serve any kind of deity or God that couldn't handle me asking why. Okay? Much less have an answer. But that really moved me. Michael, you had a particularly challenging role in all of this, not only in speaking at the vigil, but in a particular role with the funeral. Are you able to talk about that? And what that experience was like for you, helping to prepare him?
It was difficult. I mean, me and Rio have been friends for a long time. We had public relationship as friends and a private one. I've seen him cry. He's seen me cry. We've talked about life. We've talked about where we want to go, who we want to be. And I really feel like it was coming full circle for him. He became the individual he wanted to be. He became the person he wanted to be. He was happy with himself, with his friends, with his family. And I couldn't have asked for a more charitable, happy, sweet person to be in my life. You know, I'm going to miss him for the rest of my life. And absolutely. I had the privilege to do his, prepare him for his funeral. And I got a chance to talk to him, you know, alone.
And when you say prepare him, specifically, you mean you did what?
His makeup.
His makeup. Because if you know Rio, first of all, first of all, that face is going to be beat no matter what.
For the gods.
Yeah,
beat for the gods.
We definitely love makeup, the both of us.
Absolutely. So. And again, I have to quote Tariqi, and he said, my son was flawless. At least he died pretty. And that's it's a very sort of Rio kind of thing. What was that like, though? I know you said you got some one-on-one time with him. What was that experience like for you in terms of being able to spend, to not only do that, but to spend that time with him?
Well, initially it was really rough. The funeral director actually grabbed my hand because I was shaking so hard. My hands were shaking, and she was like, baby, just relax. You're going to be able to do this. You're going to get through this. You know, after she gave me that push, I was able to get through it. I was able to focus. I also had Rio's auntie was there with me, holding my hand every step of the way. So I thank her for that, definitely.
She's right here, and in fact, I'm going to bring her into the conversation. I know Tasha's like me. She's a chatty box. I know she's been sitting on her hands this whole time. You did so good. Tasha, let me just say to you, thank you so much. When I first called Monique, she said, would you work with Tasha? And I said, absolutely. And from jump, you were just so easy to work with. Always answered my calls, always responded to texts. Tell us about your relationship with Rio and what this whole experience has been like for you.
Well, we're actually cousins, and I'm older than he is, of course. So he's kind of just been the little cousin, but always that one little cousin who was always in the good mood and always happy, always wanting to hug, always wanting just to love on you, you know. Other little kids want to give her, you know, get on that. You know,
right.
These old people here, you know, let's get away from them. But, you know, he embraced everybody, no matter what age. So as we got older, I think we connected because we were able to communicate with each other. And having somebody who can understand you or who doesn't judge your person was, you know, very important for me. And it was also important for him. So that's why he and I were so close, because we could talk about anything and it wouldn't be a judging session. It would simply, you know, be for me to get whatever off my chest or he to get whatever off his chest. And then.
So it really was a two-way street, this relationship.
Yeah. So it's been hard, but a certain type of pieces, it's a different type of piece because of everybody that he's brought together. So in knowing that, someone can do that in 24 years.
24 years old.
Gave me hope that for all of us, because we all need exactly what he was giving us.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that. It was Michael's mother, Danica. She said to me at the solidarity walk after the vigil, she said, looking at this crowd, it has caused me to rethink my life. Your mom said this, Michael. She said it's caused me to rethink my life in terms of my own circles of influence and the diversity or the lack thereof, to see the impact that Rio had. And I have to tell you, even for me, I had several moments where it's like, I hope I have had and will have that kind of impact on people's lives. What do you guys, I'm going to ask each of you, what do you want most for people to know about Rio? And I'm going to start with you, Tasha.
Well, I don't have to tell people that he's loved, because that's evident. I mean, there's nothing that I can say, because he spoke for himself. So, if I had to say something to anybody, would just, you know, to find your likeness. Find people you want to be like. Mm. And yes. surround yourself with them. And that's what he did, because there were so many people who just, his likeness, they wanted to be like him, happy, whatever.
And that energy, yeah.
There was an energy there mm-hmm. that people gravitated toward. And that has brought us all together. So let's hold on to that. That's one thing.
Michael, what about you? What do you most want people to know about your dear friend, Riel?
If anything, I second just what Tasha said. Yeah, so many different friends. He made me become friends with people that I didn't get along.
That's the impact of Riel to open you up, yeah.
He's world peace. Riel is world peace.
Riel is world peace.
Yeah. I would just definitely agree with both of you, but I would definitely say Riel would probably want everyone to just be who they are and, like, just accept it, you know, love yourself, definitely. Yes, he was definitely loved, but he would definitely want you to love yourself, most importantly. TC2 forever, I love you, Riel.
You said it well, Chandretta, because I think at the vigil, I said the thing that I admired the most about Rio is that because he lived his life so fully and freely and unashamed, in turn, it frees other people to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really does. You know, absolutely,
it's
infectious.
It's infectious.
People, I had people inbox me and say things like, one of my friends, in fact, she was on the show, Misha Roberts was on the show singing a couple months ago, and she said that she knew him because she drove for Uber Eats, and she was going to pick up the food. And she was like, that's my baby, I know him, he gave me makeup tips or whatever.
Yes.
I got so many people, and even the detectives, I heard Monique say this, the detectives that are working the case knew him because he worked the Chipotle downtown.
Exactly.
So, Rio, we're not done talking about you by any means, but it says something that your life, and even in death, you're still bringing people together. And with that, I want to thank Michael and Chandretta and Tasha. I've got a song that I want to dedicate to Rio. It's called Cracks in the Foundation, and it's by Ida Ide. Many of you will remember Ida from an earlier episode of the show, and she was here in studio with us, and she'll be back soon. But this song is dedicated to Rio. I think you'll listen and understand why. Wow, fantastic. That was Cracks in the Foundation by Ida Ide. And I chose that song because she talks about living transparently, and I know where I'm going because I know who I am, and that's how I feel about Rio and his life. I am honored and moved to be joined in studio by the parents of Teron, Rio Carson, and I'm going to say a few things before I give them a chance to speak and formally introduce them. I have been so overwhelmed by your strength and your grace. I mean that with all sincerity. I've been absolutely blown away that you were at a fundraiser the night before, a drag fundraiser no less, the night before the funeral, and everything we came to you with, Monique, you just, like, yes, do it, and I hope that you've been pleased.
Yes.
I also want to say that I am thankful on behalf of every LGBT person who has reached out or expressed support in this city, because often I have had to bury many of my LGBT friends, and it is not a given that we get to participate, and certainly not at the level of access that you guys gave us. It's just not a given, and I appreciate that. Even at the funeral at the church, it was so compelling because everybody was just there. I was walking out to run an errand outside with Tasha really quick, and I looked up, and there was a middle-aged white guy with a white fur coat on and a rainbow feather boa, and just looking out across. But everybody was welcome, and I appreciate that. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Unbossed and Unbothered, Monique Carson and Tariq Hopkins, the parents of Teron Carson. Welcome, guys. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
I, of course, have a lot of questions. I'm one of those people who likes to be prepared, but the thing I want to know most is, how are you guys holding up right now?
Still unbelievable. you know. Can't believe we're here, especially when we go to certain events or happen to do all the things when you bury somebody.
Yeah.
It's just like, man, I can't believe we here.
Yeah.
You know, he's supposed to be burying us.
Right.
You know, but the outpour of love kind of helped us get over, you know.
Monique, what about you? How are you doing?
I'm blessed.
Take your time.
It is still unbelievable.
Where were you when you got the news?
I was at home. My son just texted me. I had texted him and said, whose car is in front of the house? And he texted me back and was like, I'm on my way home. That's not for me. And 10 minutes later, I get a knock at the door. Wow. Saying my son was shot.
And I, when I reached out to you for this interview, one of the commitments that I made, I don't want to glorify the crime. It's heinous. I have said in every interview that I've done that I hope the full weight of the criminal justice system collapses on the heads of those responsible, every single one of them. I want to focus on who he was as a person, his life, and also you two as individuals, because you created a culture of love that made him possible. And at the vigil, Tariq, I believe it was you, said something that was really just so profound to me. You said, we knew he was gay before he knew, before he even knew what all those parts did down there.
Yeah.
What was the moment? I want. What was her defining moment?
Well, he was about to be off to college. His auntie wanted him to stay in town. But his parents be like, hey, go live your life and experience life, you know. You need that. Get away from us. Go. We want the house. So, we was like, we want you to be comfortable with who you are. You know, it wasn't our job to say, we know that, you know, you're gay, so just come out and say. It wasn't us to say.
When was the moment, Monique? When did you know?
I knew when he was younger.
Yeah.
Okay. Young. Real young.
A lot of times, black parents, because of how we are culturally and yes. The religious element of it, it can feel like I did something wrong, therefore my child is gay or lesbian or whatever or trans, and so I got to fix something I did. Or what was that like for you? You knew at an early age.
Just waiting on him to let us know.
Okay.
Because I knew when he was just
be comfortable.
5, 6, I knew. I didn't say anything to anyone, but I knew.
What was the tale?
Was it just
a mother's intuition? Walked. Okay.
He was very entertaining.
Yeah, very.
That's a nice way of putting it. That's very PC, Dad. He's very entertaining.
He was very entertaining. And the thing about him was, it was just, he didn't mind being in the front, you know, but we wanted him to be in the front and be comfortable with him. And I know as in the black community, we are hard on our gay men.
Yeah.
You know, we'll accept lesbian women before we accept black gay men.
Yeah. And I think that's because most heterosexual men feel like they can cure that. They can cure lesbianism. Yeah. So they think there's some hope with that.
Yeah, yeah. And then also with us, we, you know, I don't know, a lot of black men feel like it's something contagious that you can catch. It's something like, oh my God, get that away from me.
Right.
If you touch me, or people going to think I'm this, that, and the other. And I have an array of friends. And the thing is, I tell people all the time, hey, listen, my best friend was messing with a woman who I couldn't stand. So who he sleep with has no bearing on why we're friends.
Right.
You know, so that's nothing.
But you did say something really profound there, because it is often true, especially, you know, this hyper masculinity. We feel like we have to, because I think for a lot of heterosexual or straight black men, it's like, as black men, we got a lot to deal with already.
Yeah.
You're making it worse. I think that sometimes, and I don't know if you ever thought about this or if people approach you, Monique, with this notion of, well, we have so much to deal with. I just want you to navigate life successfully. And you got that on top of it. Did were people as supportive of you supporting your son?
They had no choice.
They had no choice. Yeah. Why was that?
because that's my son, and it didn't matter.
You sure right. You sure right.
So, was there ever any moment where there was a religious element to it for you guys? Was it like,
No.
He loved God. And as a parent, all you can ask for is your kid to be a great human being.
Yes.
And love something higher than yourself. Now, whatever religion he would have chosen or whatever wouldn't have mattered to us. You still our son.
Right.
That ain't going to never change. Who love you and what relationships you have outside of us don't change.
So that raises another interesting question for me. Let me rephrase that. What do you say to the parent, black or otherwise, what do you say to the parent who has a gay child, and I'm using gay very generically, but who has a child who may be trans or bi or is a lesbian or queer? What do you say to that parent because they're struggling with acceptance? Maybe because of whatever their own thoughts are, maybe because of religious beliefs. What do you say to that mother, Monique?
I just know how I felt. It didn't matter to me. That's something that I had. That's something that God gave me.
Mm.
So if you can't embrace that, there's something wrong with you. So I don't know. I was fine with it. I hate being put on the spot.
All right. You're doing a great job, by the way. You're doing a fantastic job.
But
the acceptance of others it's not going to pay your light bill.
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, the acceptance of others don't mean anything. Your household got to be strong, and whatever, you know, you want people to like or love your son because he's straight or whatever, it's always going to be somebody on the other side to hate him for something.
Mm.
So
embrace your kids. Love them.
Embrace them.
No matter
what.
No matter what, yeah.
Yeah. You know, we get together for, like, it's St. Patrick's Day. Everybody hugging each other at a bar right now.
Right.
Drunk, and they've dropped their prejudices, their racism, and everything else because they're drinking together. Why can't you just do that for love?
Right.
You know?
Right. Why does it take that to make that happen?
Exactly.
For you guys, the outpouring of support from across the community, can you talk a little bit about what that has meant to you individually?
It made us realize how amazing our son was.
Mm-hmm.
I cry because I'm not sad that he's gone. I cry because it's how amazing he was. And for him to be 24 and for him to affect all of these people,
mm-hmm.
I tell my husband and I thank him. We did an amazing job.
Y'all did.
So,
you did an amazing job.
I'm fine.
You know how famous Flo is? I got one of my best friends is a gay guy, and he used to be like, man, come to my club. You know, I always come to your clubs, come to my club. I ain't got no problem with that. And I went to a Flo drag show, and I didn't know how big across the world that Flo was known. Mm-hmm. And when Rio,
you call him whatever you call him.
Yeah, okay, I'll say
Stinky.
Stinky. I forgot about that.
Stinky had his first drag show, and he came to me and asked. He said, "Will you be there?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm gonna be there. I'm gonna be there.
Not a second thought.
And he came over to us, and he was like, "I'm so glad y'all here. Like, why wouldn't we be here?"
Yeah.
You putting on a show, you gonna be here. You know, he even tried his hand at comedy before too.
But I didn't know that, but I can see that. Because Rio was, I mean, especially he was a clown. I mean, he loved to make people laugh. He was an entertainer.
Loved the spotlight, man. And he was actually funnier than me that night. I'm still jealous a little bit of him.
Right, because you're a stand-up comic, which I didn't know that until you sat in this chair in the studio. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yes, but I was like, man, he just, whatever show he had, we was going to be there. His favorite cousin sitting over there, Tasha, she going to be there.
Right.
No matter what was going on, we was going to make sure we cleared that up and made sure we was going to be there. And he put on a dang on good show, man.
But it seems like, obviously by your example, it set a tone for the whole rest of the family. Here's how this is going to go.
Yeah.
One of my aunts who passed away a few years ago, Kathy Wright, extraordinarily brilliant and beautiful woman. I didn't come out to her. It's like she came in to me. I don't know how to make this. She's like, look here. I know what's going on, and I'm all right with it. And if anybody else in this family got a problem with it, you tell them to come see me. And that was that.
Yeah.
But when you set that tone, it makes it clear for everybody else. And to see how all the family, at everything that I've seen, like, there's been so much family there, too. Like,
and see, that wasn't a conversation. That his sexuality wasn't a conversation in our household at all. It wasn't a conversation.
That's so beautiful.
It was just that stinky, you know. And like I said at the vigil, he always went out with a fresh haircut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He would always ask me before he go up, line me up. I'm about to go out. Well, okay, I'll line you up later. I'm about to leave in an hour. Well, why don't you tell me that earlier? But he
see me right now.
Yeah, but he want to be lined up. That's it. To where I had to tell him, you're gonna learn how to do this yourself.
Right.
You wanna line every weekend or whatever. I don't even cut my hair that much here. So he learned how to line himself up, and he was gonna do that before he left. And as hard as it was seeing him laying there, it was still like he would have been still happy, because he would have been like, look at me looking there, looking all good.
Okay, okay. True confessions. I had a moment, and I don't like to go to funerals. I want to remember people where I saw them and how I remember them. But I knew I needed to be there, and I was willing to do that. But I had a moment when I was standing there at the viewing at the casket. And I just felt like he was there like, yeah, this is how it's supposed to be.
Yes.
This is crowded. Right? This crowded room of people.
You know what it reminded me of? One of my favorite movies, and it's crazy. It reminded me of The Birdcage.
I love it. Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. I love the movie. Yeah.
And the wedding at the end.
Yes.
That's what his funeral reminded me of, because it was so many different people. Yeah. And it was
That's true. Yeah.
It was like The Birdcage. It was amazing.
I'm going to watch that this week in honor of him. I know you don't like to be put on the spot, Monique. And I'm not going to put you on the spot. I'm going to try not to.
Okay.
As I was thinking about today's program, a song occurred to me. And it's by the same artist. And I felt like it was Rio's dedication to you. So far be it from me to say that, but if you allow me that, I'd like to play you this song called Mama by Ida Ide. Mama by Ida Ide. And I just want to say thank you both for being so amazing. Somebody, I think it was Angel, because a lot of people don't know, you have a whole Latino contingent of children now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a whole broad contingent of gay sons and daughters, you know. Before I go to the last segment of the show, I just want to ask you guys a final question. Monique, I think it was at the drag show, you said, we don't want this in here. We want to do more. We want to work with you.
Yes.
And you said the same thing, basically, Trick, when you came in. So what is you guys' heart in terms of working with the LGBT community here in Kansas City that your son was such a prominent part of?
I want to see what he was doing, and I want to fill in that spot.
Mm.
Whatever I can do as far as my occupation, you know, and give, you know. I hate that it's labeled or has to be labeled anything that has to be labeled black or LGBTQ, whatever. You know, I just want to help people.
Yeah.
And if I want to fill in where my son was at.
On behalf of, I always joke and say I'm no Martin Luther Queen. I don't get to speak for all the gays. But on behalf of all of us, yes, welcome. We've received that. And one of the things that I've committed to doing with Blackout, my organization, I shouldn't say my organization, the organization that I'm honored to serve, is we're going to establish not a motherboard like they have in the church, the motherboard, the mothers of the church, but a mother board. We need, because it's mothers and others. And in time, when you're ready, I would love to welcome you to be a part of that, because the love that you and the acceptance that you showed your son, a lot of people don't have that, and they would be blown away to get a hug or have somebody that's there as a support who is also a black mama like their mom. And that means something. It means something. And like I said, when you're ready, I would love to ask you to do that and have you be a part of that.
I would love to.
Yay! Okay. That's awesome. I appreciate that. So the last segment of the show is one more thing, and one more thing is where I really get to rant about something, but I don't have a rant today as much as I have just a little something for us to kind of put in our pocket and think about. I know today's show we talked about a young black gay man, 24 years old, but I think it's also important, too, that we remember our LGBT elders, particularly our black LGBT elders, because a lot of times they don't have the support and the connectivity to the community, and they become isolated, or they are isolated. They die very alone a lot of times. I was very struck by the fact that of the sparse research that's even out there about black LGBT elders, most of them are experienced chronic levels of discrimination, poverty, social isolation, physical and mental health disparities, and that is something that we can turn around. One gentleman, I read an article, said, "Our generation did so much for LGBTQ and civil rights. We shouldn't just be thrown away. It's sad, but so many of us feel invisible as we get older. If we don't take care of ourselves, we're going to get lost in the sauce." And I think there's this fear of backlash and discrimination that pushes many into retreat. And I just want to say, if you are among the LGBT elders that are out there, I welcome you into our movement, and I want to find ways to work with you. You have value. You have value. You have value, and we want you to be a part of this, and we want to learn from you, and we want to get to know you and have you get to know us. So think about that. It's something that, you know, many of us don't even give a second thought to what we do, where we go, you know. But there used to be people who had to walk around saying, "Hey, are you a friend of Dorothy?" And that was code for, "Hey, girl, hey," you know. So just keep that in mind. As we go, I want to thank all of our guests, and I'm going to invite them back over. You guys can come share the mic. Where's Tasha? Where's Tasha? Come over, Tasha. Tasha and Chandretta. Thank you, Jermaine Alberti and Michael Farmer, for joining us by phone. Langston Jones for being our video guy for Facebook Live today. Those of you listening via radio can't see the beautiful scene in the studio right now, but a lot of hugs and smiles. There's been a lot of Kleenex passed around, too. Tasha, I'm going to give you the final word on today's show, and then I'm going to play us out with a song called Down by, again, Ida Ade. So when you're ready.
Love everyone. That'll be my final word. Learn to love everyone.
Give out hugs, baby.
Yes. For free.
For free. Give out hugs for free. On that note, you've been listening to Unbossed and Unbothered here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Down by Ida Ade.